Welcome back to another episode of Barely Legal in Web3. Today we're talking about cryptocurrency and digital payments licensing in Singapore. Joining me are three amazing guests. First, we have Justine Zhang, who is Compliance Director at Bitdeer. We have Ruben Consencio, who is Senior Strategy Consultant at HM. And we have Samson Leo, who is Chief Legal Officer at FAZ. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So to kick it off, maybe we can do some introductions. I'd love to learn more about what you do and essentially what your company does. So Justine, why don't you start us off?
Okay. Ladies first.
Exactly.
Okay. Yes. Hi, I'm Justine Zhang. This is actually the first time we meet offline. As Jamila just mentioned, I'm the compliance director in BDF Group, which is a crypto mining firm specialized in providing crypto mining solutions to global customers. Currently, we have 6 mining farms across the world, majorly in US, in Bhutan, and in Norway. And with our expertise, we do crypto mining, proprietary mining for ourselves, and also we do machine hosting in our mining farm. If the customer find it too tedious to manage the machine themselves, we can just host their machine, provide our service, and client can still mine the coin. And besides that, if the customer don't own any machine or don't want to purchase anything, we have this cloud mining solution where you generally just purchase our hash rate, which is just our computing power, which essentially can get you coins mined. So that's cloud mining. And besides that, recently we're launching our mining machine, mining rigs. It's called Theo Miner. So it's now under reservation phase. So you can just like pay $0.99 to secure your stock when it launched. This will enhance our end-to-end crypto mining solution to our customers. And last but not least, we have this partnership with NVIDIA recently. Using our data center managing expertise to engage in AI business, which everyone feels is like a future business. So that's what we do. And I, as a compliance officer, oversee this coal company because last year we just got NASDAQ listed. And at the same time, because our product feature everything, although it's not regulated, we still need to have solid AML and sanction control over the product and customer. So I just oversee this tool. Yeah, that's what I do now. And before that, I was also in a local startup applying for the PSA license, including DPT. And fortunately, we were the first batch getting the license in DPT license in Singapore. And the firm is, I think you know, it's like DTC Pay, doing crypto payment currently. Yes. And prior to that, I would just spend almost a decade working in banking industry, still doing AML all the time. So that's about me.
Thank you so much, Justine. And you're, really in the middle of the eye of the storm of excitement. You've got Bitcoin mining, you've got the rig activity, you've got the partnership with NVIDIA. It's just, going public. It's really just a lot of activity. Sounds very exciting.
Yes, that indeed it is.
Awesome. Ruben, why don't you tell us a bit about you and what you do?
Thanks, Jamila. Really happy to be here. I'm Ruben Consencio, Senior Strategy Consultant at HM Strategy, a boutique consulting firm. We offer strategy, legal, and regulatory advisory and in-house counsel services. I'm also the head of Asian markets at Everlasting, a Web3 technology firm that offers a wallet with on-chain MPC approvals using for multi-orgs and multi-chains, as well as staking services and legacy planning using smart contracts. Our mission is actually to secure wealth over lifetimes. Previously, I was with Sparrow, a Singapore-based digital asset derivatives firm, that successfully managed to get the major payments institution license from the MAS for the Payment Services Act. So really happy to be here and on this panel and really excited to share our journey.
We're excited to listen and understand kind of what you've seen in your role being a strategic advisor to a lot of these companies. Very cool. And Samson, last but not least, tell us a bit about FAS and what you do there.
Sure thing. Thanks, Jamila. So I'm Samson Liu, Chief Legal Officer of FAS and StraitsX. FAS is a fintech company in the payment space. So we help businesses collect and send digital payments. In Indonesia, we help micro businesses collect and send digital payments. And we move up to the SMEs, the small and medium enterprises, and all the way up to the enterprise businesses where we provide customized API payment solutions. Now, moving towards the future, we envision that Web3 type payments becoming, it would become a lot more prevalent. And part of that initiative under our StraitsX brand is where we issue a stable coin. So in our payments business here in Singapore, we have one major payment institution license and we have three in-principle approvals for digital payment token services. That's where the StraitsX stablecoin issuance business would fall under. And we've been very, very fortunate that our customers have been really receptive to the use of our stablecoins. So to date, when we first launched our stablecoin to now, in about a short span of about 3 years, we're looking at about 7.9 billion XSGD transacted on the chain. And we are across 4 chains now, Ethereum, Silica, Hedera, and Polygon. So that's kind of where we are. And I think the focus of today's conversation will be a lot more around our stablecoin and Web3 payments in general. Really happy to share our experience.
That's really impressive, first off. And, you know, there's so much talk about when you think of stablecoins, you think of primarily, I think most people think of USD-backed stablecoins.
Yes.
And what you've discussed SGD.
Yes.
And you guys also have another stablecoin that's backed as well. Can you tell us a bit about the significance of having these sorts of diverse currency-backed stablecoins?
Exactly. So, Jamila, we are a payments company focusing on Southeast Asia. So here in Singapore and in the region, the Singapore dollar has proved to be one of the currencies that have a lot of trust amongst the people here in Southeast Asia. There is, of course, always the recognition of a US dollar-backed stablecoin, of which you've mentioned. I think there are quite a few out there. For us, our focus on our customers has been around the Singapore and Indonesia, and so therefore our Singapore-backed stablecoin. We have a rupiah-backed stablecoin, XIDR, and soon to come we'll be issuing a US dollar stablecoin just because some of our customers want to now start transacting internationally.
So it really is a matter of addressing the needs of the market, of the people here.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you think that that is something that you guys may expand even more to include even more currencies in your portfolio?
So Jamila, it's funny you ask, because I think in our conversations prior to this, we talked about the genesis of why did we even issue a stable coin, right? As I've shared, we are a payment service provider. Now, some of our customers are on the Web3 space. So they used us for our fiat payment collections and fiat payment sending. Now, the problem that some of them faced was the very long integration lead time and the long integration technical expertise required to integrate the APIs. So I think that was kind of the aha moment for us, because we were thinking, okay, so these Web3 natives, what do they do? I mean, the fact that they are Web3 natives, they already integrate tokens on an ERC-20 standard. They integrate this as part and parcel of their Web3 business, whether be it they are issuing some sort of NFT, whether be it that they are a crypto exchange or offering exchange services for different tokens. So the aha moment for us was, what if we offered our fiat payment channels, but put it in a format that helped them integrate it so much easier, as if it was just one of the other tokens that they are very accustomed to dealing with. So that's where we first launched our payment service as e-money, and then putting the e-money on the blockchain and thereby creating this stable coin. And so that was the start of our journey.
So you essentially looked at the issues that Web3 businesses are having, particularly founders. I mean, ByteBow, we work with a lot of companies that have this challenge where they think, okay, I've set up my legal entity. Yeah. I've got funds coming in. Oh, wait, I don't have an off-ramp.
Yeah,
I don't have an off-ramp solution. Exactly. And so you saw that and said, huh, you know, this is the solution that we're going to provide.
Exactly.
You know, thinking about Web3 businesses and Web3 founders, Justine, I've seen a lot of this sort of progression towards an interest in Bitcoin mining. And Bitcoin obviously gets a lot of attention because it is Bitcoin and it's one of, you know, the first cryptos out there that people are really focused on and looking at. Halving is coming up soon. What really is the solution that Bitdeer provides to, let's say, your average Web3 founder that maybe wants to start a Bitcoin mining company and they have nothing, they just have an idea?
Yeah, well, the company has been up running for quite some year already when, before last bull market. So back then, the company's expertise is just like running the mining farms, like initially in China, but gradually they're shifting the business out because China got certain restriction of this kind of industry. So the company's expertise, crypto mining, so a data center build up. So most essentially, they need to find some place where got a competitive electricity price and also reasonable infrastructure, like uninterrupted internet and everything. So the company choose to set the mining farms initially in US and Norway, and in between is some South Asia, Southeast Asia country, and then recently Bhutan. So I understand the major profit-making part is proprietary mining, because we own the machine, we own the farms, and they're just you mine and you get the harvest Bitcoin and then just get it liquidated. That's how you're making money. But I really like the idea of this kind of a mining farm, because essentially it's a data center, but we call it mining farm because as a farmer, we own many farms. We plant our own trees. And then we harvest our own apples, oranges, or whatsoever. But we realize we have extra capacity where we can say, oh, you have trees, but you don't want to, maintain it. Plant it in our farm. We take care of it, just as I said, it's hosting. So I grew the apple, I send it back to you. But of course, you need to pay me the min fee or whatever, right? And then next step is we realize, there's some customer, they don't even have trees, but they feel, I don't want the apple now, because if I want the apple now, I just go to exchange OTC to get the apple. Yeah. But I feel when it comes to the harvest season, the apple price will go higher, and then maybe it's difficult to obtain fresh apple, and then I want to get the mining now, so I invest. I pick three trees out. I want these three trees and pay you certain money. And by the harvest season, I get all the apples I need. So that's what we call cloud mining. So this part is quite creative, because if you see other miners, they majorly do proprietary mining.
Yeah.
But for us, we have a diversity of mining solutions. And during this, tree growing process, we have developed a very advanced internal process management. We can allocate each tree Is that growing normally, or does it need for further watering, sunshine enough, everything? And then we have this internal system called Minor Plus, which we can just, you know, keep monitoring the progress. And also for our customer, we give them the access to view how their trees is growing as well. So real time, they can capture what's going on. I think it's like quite user friendly. And that's overall about the mining business. And now the company finally start building and developed its own mining machine, just as I launching that, I think just mid-April, they will be launching. So just right before, or just like before, after the crypto Bitcoin halving. So we will see how it goes. But the team, I have faith in them, because like very, like have a lot of like experts in this industry, and that's going to be very exciting. Yeah.
So then Bitcoin mining can really be for anyone, really. I mean, anyone can just, you know, learn about the process, but then learn through you guys and also use the services to mine Bitcoin on their own.
Yes, it wouldn't be very difficult, because, you know, nowadays with like the crypto halving, like if you want to make profit from this industry, it need to be very scalable. It cannot be you just set up two home PC in your backyard and connect to, you know, electricity and internet. You know, like a Singapore electricity bill is like crazy, right? So it should be scalable, and you need to really know how to do a configuration, maintenance, and make it high performance. So you don't need to have all this trouble. You just, you know, do cloud mining, which you just simply like purchase the hash rate, and you can just try and generate it. It's just like slightly different from you go with the OTC and exchange to buy something, but it means that you still think the crypto industry is very promising, that the prices go higher. Just, you know, I want Apple soon, and I'll just invest now.
I mean, these are really forward thinking ideas. You have, you know, this perception that, and the reality, quite frankly, that Web3 businesses have an issue with off-ramp. And so how do you create the solution to get the off-ramp set up in an easy way that they can understand? And then you have this, you know, idea that Bitcoin mining should be accessible to everyone, and not just accessible. Let me help you look at the data on how to improve your Bitcoin mining. And it's very interesting to see these trends, you know, and I think globally people should look at Singapore and kind of see, you know, what's happening here. And, you know, that's obviously, you know, one of the reasons for the show and why we're here is to talk about what's happening locally in Singapore. And, you know, just coming in, that's kind of what I see. I see that there's a lot of innovation. And Ruben, you know, you're here and you're working on strategy stuff and you're talking to companies all the time. Is this sort of the trend that you're seeing, that there's more and more ideas coming out to help businesses and then also individuals get into the space?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're seeing, of course, price is marketing, right? So as you see Bitcoin prices move, the amount of inquiries and interest grows as well. And we're seeing very interesting new business models in one sector. For me, I've observed a lot more interest is in the non-financial asset sector. So we know traditionally, like, you know, people would say, oh, can I get into the ETF? Can I get into a fund, for example, right? So these are all financial assets, lending, borrowing, staking. Okay, these are all straightforward. But what about token issuers that are trying to do real-world asset tokenization? Real-world assets, but they're using tokenization to get better reach, better distribution, better investors, right? So this is one area that I'm seeing a lot of growth and interest. And I think Tradify as well is also looking at it, but still early days, right? The other area is people who have been in crypto for some time, and they're saying, unfortunately, in the early days, we weren't able to comply or be clearly compliant because maybe the standards were not there, or we didn't have the capability or interest at that point. But we want to make everything that we have be recognizable. We can book it. We can pay our taxes appropriately. So I think that there's a lot of interest in this space. So for example, like the XSGD, that's a very important stable coin that actually allows people to do trade across borders, and you know, something that actually works with existing financial frameworks. You know, very often in the early days, at least, I remember the last bull run, everyone was like, oh, it's a whole new world. the old world won't matter. And you know, you heard the BitConnect guy, right? But let's be real, guys. Let's be adults in the room, right? We know that there are some things in the past that maybe were not ideal, and that's why decentralized assets, decentralized finance starts to rise. But at the same time, there are some very good practices, especially on risk, on compliance, that are essential to a functioning financial system and will protect us from the large implosions we saw in 2022. So I think that it's about everyone trying to reach out to each other and say, let's build something that's actually usable by humans. I mean, I'll just be very specific here. Like, most of us don't know how the electricity actually gets to us. We just know we flip a switch and it works.
Right.
We know how to use banking. That way we write a check, or in Singapore, we just send PayNow or something.
Yeah.
But crypto's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
And I think that crypto is going to do for transactions what Instagram did for photos. You don't have to be a Photoshop expert to come up with a filter and post a bunch of nice pics. I think what we are all building, and from different disciplines, different sides of the coin, we're going to arrive at the same point, but that's where it starts. It starts here.
Yeah. I think it's a mindset change, right? Like, we're trying to make things, if I say we are, like, I'm a founder, we're a tech founder soon. But you guys are trying to make things easier for businesses and everyday people to do what they need to do in the space. And it is a mindset shift, and it's busting a myth. And I like to kind of have this segment to talk about myth busters, because, you know, quite frankly, a lot of the entrepreneurs that I speak to, when they think about Singapore, they think, I'm afraid to go there and set up. I'm afraid to go to Singapore to set up a business. Yeah. And that's a myth based upon their ideas about getting licensed, about taxes, about operating and navigating a business in Singapore. And so, just to kind of bust that myth, Samson, what really has been the experience in, you mentioned the licenses that FAS has in getting those licenses?
Well, I might be biased, right? Because I'm Singaporean. Of course, Singapore is a great place to do business.
Yeah.
We started this company, we incorporated it back in 2014, so it's been 10 years since. There's been a lot of governmental support in terms of capability development, in terms of hiring, wages, support, and even government grants in certain selected areas. So the general ecosystem here has been very, very conducive for startups as well as new SMEs to really grow in the region. So that I see as a foundational enabling piece, right? Next, for the regulated businesses, I think that's kind of where there may be some concerns from some of the international companies. There may be some concerns on the kind of, maybe they see news articles about our regulators being very tough on certain stances. Like, for example, MAS. The MAS has said before that trading in cryptocurrencies is very risky. They've also warned consumers about it. And that may be seen or perceived by the international community that Singapore is not welcoming to Web3, which actually is very, very, very far from reality. So we see the speculative trading of certain crypto tokens. I think that is the one that MES is frowning upon. Because if you really think about it, maybe they don't see a real value creation from an economic point of view, right? You're not growing trees, you're not producing apples, you're just taking existing apples and buying and selling them for a higher price with no value addedness. So I think if anything, Singapore has been very consistent is in value adding. It's how do we take something and improve upon it and thereby create value for ourselves and for the world. And so if we look at it from that lens, I think for any entrepreneur or international businesses who want to come to Singapore, as long as you look at it from the lens of how do I add value to the customers, to the ecosystem, to the world, I believe they would feel very welcoming that a lot of those policies are actually enabling them to do so. So our personal example is our stablecoin business. So if we recall, it was just short, like 1 or 2 years ago, where we had certain stable coins that unraveled and were not as stable as we thought it would be. And one of the reactions the regulators had around the world was then looking at this asset class, right? It's the asset class of a stable coin and seeing like, what is the use case of a stable coin? Does it have a use in the world, in the financial system of today? And I think regulators around the world do recognize that there is a place for stable coins or coins that reference or take value to a government-issued fiat currency. So with that value in mind, and I can share with you more on our work with Project Orchid, but with that value in mind, I think that's where the government came about enabling legislation to help consumers differentiate between the different classes of stablecoins, and then to regulate one class of stablecoins as being more consumer, with a kind of stablecoin with more consumer protection. So I think that's kind of where you see how the government's enabling policy has impacted a business like ours, where we're trying to create real world value.
I like to think of it as, you know, how you're describing it. It's like child asks the parent for a snack before dinner, right? Can I have these chips? No. You said I can't eat. No, you can't eat the chips. How about you have this, right? And so it's a redirection to focus on the value or the nutrients, right? Mm. What is actually good and what is going to support the economic activity in the country? And, you know, I think it's a fair narrative. It's fair to really look at the fact that some things the market may not be ready for at this time.
Mm.
There needs to be more education. There needs to be more examples, more use cases. Mm. We need to collect more data. But for now, these are the things that are available. These are the things that you can do. And, you know, I always look at technology as an evolution of our understanding of how you can use it and what are the pros and cons along the way. And for example, even with Bitcoin mining, you know, in the US, Americans, when they hear Bitcoin, they really don't have much understanding. And I'm speaking very generally, but I can't because I'm American here. I don't really have much understanding on Bitcoin except for buying and selling. The idea of Bitcoin mining seems to be something that is unattainable. You have to be very knowledgeable about cryptocurrency. You need to have this, you need to have that. And so once again, there's a need to educate. There's a need to sort of onboard in that space. And maybe you can talk a bit about that myth. I mean, if someone comes and says, I cannot mine Bitcoin, I don't have a rig of my own.
Yes. Yeah.
We already provide a solution just now. But I understand this, just talking about my own experience. Before I was shifting to crypto industry, my only understanding about this industry is all high risk. You know, from a bank's compliance perspective, untouchable high risk stuff. Because you don't understand how it works, how is the mechanism behind. And just as you said, like it's like in Singapore, why I like Singapore government, they take a I would think a proactive approach here. Mm. It's like some part of the world I don't understand. I just don't touch. I ban it as a whole.
Yes.
Because I don't understand. But Singapore's like, okay, kids, if you guys want to do, maybe let me as a parent understand it first. Tax if it's risky or not. Or like, is that, if it's risky, what is the level? Is that takeable, or is that something we can take and we make it better so you guys can try out? So that is like more experimental, although everyone back then is not very clear about like what's going on and where we are heading for, because there were many, many new products, just like not just crypto mining. Crypto mining is just like where the coins is mined, but transaction and like then custodian and then all this kind of things. Like even I stay in this industry for 5 years, I'm still like quite confused of like new ideas, like how it works. So this educational thing is just like, I would say, not just like as a layman, like we as industry player provide you a very straightforward solution, just follow. But even for us in the field, we are educating ourselves every day.
Yes.
And regulators, I don't dare to use the word educate. We teach each other.
Yeah,
we share like our perspective. Sometimes like my own perspective is you don't understand something enough, you don't dare to try. So we see the tendency like more and more government trying to regulate and trying to allow, like give the bridge between crypto product and the traditional financial instrument, because they are getting more and more comfortable with, you know, our efforts as compliance and legal people. We convince them, although the risk is here, here's the control. Mm. Here's the control. We can mitigate the risk and make it more accessible to the like market, to the mass market. So that like everyone got protected, yet you can invest just like, you know, traditional financial institutions. So education thing is important, but it's like the whole industry is learning together. That's my perspective. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah.
Well, I'll second what Justine says, right? In our experience, MES has been very consultative with the industry as a whole. You can see from all their consult papers that they really take into consideration what the industry gives as feedback. And one thing that we have observed is that as a regulator, they have a fairly high level of understanding of the underlying technology. And they're not like giving just a blanket, oh, this anything to do with crypto is risky. No, in fact, they are very able to differentiate the use of the application and maybe only specific users of application of the blockchain technology, specific users of this DLT technology, which they may not want to encourage. Whereas as a whole, they may see that this technology might be an enabler for either new use cases or more efficient users of existing practices. So I think MES has been trying very much to learn, like they're just trying to figure out like how does this new technology work within the existing financial ecosystem, and does it create and expand the existing financial ecosystem? And I think that dialogue has been very, very important. So in what Justine has mentioned, they are very eager to learn. They're very eager to understand. And I think in terms of the policy forming and the legislative process, they've also been very progressive. Right? In looking forward to the future, how should financial regulations be? What are those principles? And how then does it apply to these different new technologies that come up? So that's been our experience. And I think for most of the people who can see all the consult papers and see MES like explaining their policy positions, I think it becomes quite apparent that I would say as a operator here in Singapore, I think we feel very confident and very comfortable that there is a level of visibility now and in the future.
Yeah, I think that in terms of myths, right, it's very often when you look at crypto Twitter especially, you will see extreme caricatures of the regulator's position.
Yes, okay? Yes.
So it's either MES loves crypto or hates it.
Yes.
For some, it's like there's no middle ground.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So I remember back in 2018, suddenly, President Thaman, back then he was not president yet, but he was either chairman or something at MES. He suddenly came out in the news and said, I'm all for blockchain technology. It is the fraud and speculation I do not like. And I was thinking, why would he talk, like crypto wasn't anything, you know, it wasn't that big. Then I open up my crypto Twitter, right?
Yeah.
And scammers are sending me stuff where they photoshopped his face and they put a quote in and said, "You should buy this coin, you will moon." And I was like, that's what it was. That's what it was. You know, because he couldn't outright call out the coin, because then you draw attention to the scammer, right? Yeah. You don't want that, right? So, but it was like, that's the nature of things. So then, of course, the delusion in crypto Twitter starts to separate that into some extreme examples. So for us, when we were at Sparrow and doing the license application, now remember, derivatives is not a regulated activity for digital assets, especially at that time. Yep. Just focus on spot money changing, basically. And so we said, but you know, they're not going to like it if we don't tell them the full scale of what we're doing. So we did. We said, we took the plunge. We said, we'll file a 60-page filing and let them know exactly what we're doing end to end. We were never penalized. We were never, you know, treated badly or whatever. Instead, we got very relevant, good questions to understand. All the questions were on the basis of trying to understand our business and our model.
Yep.
Now, I'll tell you this. Another company we're friends with, and they filed, you won't believe it, they filed their own self-written legal opinion. And they said, no, because now MAS has come out and said that they are all for crypto. So they were taking a very bullish approach. They said, we filed a one-page legal opinion. And I went, on your business, you're doing some interesting stuff, you know, you're not that different from us. They go, no, it's obvious. Everyone knows what Bitcoin is. And I'm like, oh God. So this is what I mean. Like sometimes we have these very extreme views of, you know, or when MAS says we want as many people to apply, then they take it as, why is MAS taking so long to issue the license? I thought you want more license holders. So, but actually they don't realize that what MAS wants is high quality license holders, responsible ones. So, and that takes a bit more work. It takes a bit more time.
I mean, there's this online particularly, there is a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of misinformation that happens on platforms like Twitter or X. And the only way to really combat that is to talk to people who've actually done it, who've actually gone through it, and then to have a good relationship with the regulator, I would say with the regulator. And I think that that's probably a best practice is to, you know, set up and establish that relationship first. You know, you don't just walk up to, you know, your friend that you haven't seen in 2 years and say, hey, let me borrow your car. You basically need to have an ongoing relationship. And that might be something that there's a huge opportunity for people to do is, you know, and this is not just for Singapore, but generally in any sort of regulatory spaces, have that relationship, have that ongoing conversation, you know, that consultative process that you're talking about. And then, you know, when your application is ready, then you submit. And I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that.
The teachers would be able to tell who like really pay attention to their homework. It's just very easy to identify. It's like one page of legal opinion versus, you know, like a 60 page of, you know, real assessment. It's quite different. So the MAS is quite sophisticated, so they know what they're looking for.
And just to be clear, I'm not saying you have to file a 60 page. Our business was so complex and we wanted to be fully transparent, fully disclosing everything, right? We didn't like, we felt that, look, it's important for them to understand what we are doing and what we're capable of doing and not capable of doing, so that at least when they give us the license, they can stand by it as much as we want to stand by what we do.
Right.
And I think that kind of transparency is important. Yeah.
Looking forward, what do you guys envision in terms of where the companies are going, but also where the market is headed? I mean, I think this whole part, I've been watching the partnership with NVIDIA. I'm very interested in the hardware side. And, you know, I have a background in trade compliance. And so following the whole semiconductor path and in terms of where it's sold, where it's bought and the supply and demand, where do you see sort of Bitdeer headed in the future in terms of product and services?
Sounds like a question for business people. Yes, like, so AI is like very like extreme hot topic now. Like everyone thinks it's the future. But for Bitdeer, it's like we're not just talking about it. Management feel, since, hey, we have this long years of field experiment on managing data center, because like the mining farm essentially is the data center. So we have a team, we have expertise, we have strong team. And since like this opportunity is there, how about just grab it, use our expertise here to do something new. So it diversify our portfolio, because it's just like crypto mining. So just one sector, but you need to explore more. Just like in Dubai, like oil and gas is an industry, but like finance and like tourism, you need to diversify. You cannot put your egg in just one basket, right? So this is like the vision we have here. So AI is there and we have good partnership with NVIDIA. So what BDR is doing is like we just partner with NVIDIA and launching I think it's the first super pod like powered by NVIDIA H100, because 200 just out but not yet in the market. It's like the first super pod in Asia. So, but it's launching. To be very honest, as a compliance person, I don't understand like the underlying logic by saying we have a dedicated team like trying to offer like AI cloud, because like we have crypto cloud and we have AI cloud to our end user. But from compliance perspective, I would say it's something like traditional cloud business, but a little bit different. And I say like there are regulators trying to look at this part and say, hey, do we need a KYC here to understand who is our end user is, and that there will be dialogue engaged in the industry currently. So that part I will still stay tuned on. But overall, AI is a very exciting topic, and we're very glad we're just part of this movement. Yeah.
Sounds very exciting.
Yeah.
Samson, what about Faz?
For us, on our Web3 side of the business, what we're really building is a payment infrastructure, right? As Ruben has mentioned, the XSGD stablecoin, or any stablecoin for that matter, is an integral part for real-world asset tokenization. If you have a token representing a bottle of wine, what do you do with it? I mean, you buy and sell it, right? And if you buy and sell it, people would normally be more comfortable receiving a fiat currency equivalent. Like I don't sell my bottle of wine for like 0.0001 Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I sell it for like maybe like 19 Sing dollars or 20 Sing dollars. So if we look at it from that lens, what we are building that enabling layer for Web3 businesses for their innovation. So for them to then have the ability to transact in a currency that they are familiar with, that is not just only the US dollars, giving them some alternative for the Southeast Asia region. I think that's something that we've been really, really pushing on and really building on. And so a question that comes to me very often is, oh, but we've got, like Singapore, we've got Fast, or we've got PayNow. In Indonesia, we have Qris. We've got so many forms of payment already. Like, what's so different? Why do we need to have a blockchain token representation of money that already exists today? So for us, one thing that we tried with MES during the FinTech Festival together with Grab and Temasek was on the concept of programmable money. And that was one of the things which the then MES MD Ravi Menon also highlighted, the use case of a programmable money. In fact, we'll say it's openly programmable money. Today, if you want to build conditions into your payment, you either go to an escrow agent and pay them an arm or a leg, or you got to convince your bank to create a very special kind of post-dated standing instruction, or what maybe for trade purposes, you might have a letter of credit that you got to tick certain boxes before the money is released. All those processes is something that we are trying to enable with the ability for anyone to openly program conditions into the money. So in Singapore FinTech Festival, we have this Project Orchid. So Project Orchid was a collaboration between us and Grab and Temasek was for how do we showcase the use of programmability in money. And in this particular case, we showcased both programmability and interoperability. How we did that was we had the XSGD token and we put a smart contract wrapper over it. So that smart contract wrapper was where we defined certain conditions, like example, expiry date, example, the limit of how many tokens can be in this smart contract, how many can be spent. Example, whitelisted recipients. So if this smart contract token is transferred to a unauthorized recipient, it would just get locked up in the smart contract. It would not be able to release the smart contract to release the XSGD token. So here's what we're building, that level of programmability that you don't even need to come to us, because it's an open blockchain. The smart contract can be programmed by you. It can be programmed by anyone. And with that, then the acceptance piece was what we showcased. So, forgive the technicalities, but when we use a smart contract to wrap the XSGD, that was represented in the form of an NFT. Because in our real-world use case, it is a voucher, right? I'm giving you a $5 voucher that expires on a certain date that you can spend on certain selected accepted Grab merchants, where you go to their Grab merchant, you scan their QR code, and you make payment, right? So in our case, we are trying to showcase the level of programmability in the form of a voucher. And each voucher is unique. And each voucher is either used or not used. And each voucher can be invalidated on a per voucher level, right? So therefore, an NFT kind of makes sense, right? But again, you see, our thinking process is not, let's create an NFT because it sounds cool. Our thinking process is like, okay, if we are trying to enable programmable money and the selected use case is giving a voucher, what use of blockchain technology can we use to enable this case? So in our case, we use an NFT, right? And from then, what we showcased in the form of interoperability was for anyone to use their self-hosted wallet to have that NFT in their wallet to scan a Grab QR code, to interpret the Grab merchant's QR code, to interpret the blockchain address, and just send their token over. From Grab's point of view, once the token is received, the smart contract unwraps, the XSGD is released, they will give a payment confirmation to their merchant. So you see, we have just opened up that ecosystem, right? You do not need to be a Grab user to make payment to a Grab merchant, and vice versa. And I think that's really the exciting part about open programmable money. And that's kind of the infrastructure that we are building.
That's amazing. You could basically have a babysitter come over, and once the kids are put to bed, you get payment, right? You could have whatever sort of conditions that you want.
And you can integrate it with your IoT devices in the house that captures the moment the babysitter walks out of the house at the appointed time. Bing.
Being paid.
Yeah, paid.
Okay.
Sign me up and I'm investing. Ruben, to close us out, can you tell us a bit about where you see the future of things headed? I mean, from your view, in terms of the evolution of the business models, and just give us a bit of your insight on that.
So I think that there'll be a convergence of two aspects. One is usability, for sure. Everyone is working on this problem. Everyone wants it to be easier to use Web3 crypto technologies and to secure their wealth. But on the other side, it's also, why do we need to change? Most people will say, hey, we already got banks, we have stock exchanges, why do we need all this new stuff? Aren't we just reinventing the wheel? To some degree, some things just work on a database, but I'll say this, there is a generational shift, especially after the great financial crisis, towards distrust of centralized financial institutions. Facebook IQ, I think in 2015, did a study on this, and they found that 90% of millennials do not trust financial institutions. 68% thinks that their banks are doing things behind their back. Now, I'm not here to say whether that's true or not, but what I am saying is, well, the best way to win trust is to show them why they should trust anything. And the best way is, as you mentioned, Samson, open technology that can be independently audited and verified. Because if not, we will have the same excesses that we saw in 2022 that saw a collapse in the crypto space. But what did survive was actually very well-built DeFi protocols. Those actually survived. Those did what they were supposed to do. Programmable money, programmable financial instruments. So to me, I think that what's going to happen in the next phase of innovation is this: making it easy enough for people to secure that, whatever their wealth or assets are, on an open blockchain and make it portable and sovereign, so that, you know, over generations and you know, you can see around the world, we're seeing more and more global unrest, wars in different places. I think we got 10 simultaneous wars right now. So you imagine, like, traditionally we'd say, well, if it's war, walk around, you know, you have gold bars. I go, okay, so I got a gold bar and I want to buy a coke. How do I get change?
I think you got to shave the gold bar.
Shave the gold bar a little.
Yeah, just a little.
You know, so it doesn't quite work, right? But with digital asset payments, for example, whether it's a stable, whether it's Bitcoin, I'm not choosing the horse, but I'm saying you got to have one and you got to have a way for it to be interoperable. And that's where the open blockchain technology works best. To me, that's a use case. That's where it goes, especially in a world that's getting more and more fragile. Actually, it gives more strength to blockchain technology as the anti-fragile solution. Yeah, so I think that's really where we're headed. And that's where I think, you know, professionals like Samson and Justine and myself, we are all trying to help businesses transition. So Web 2 was the great, you know, move away from paper thing, right? We can go across borders instantly, quickly. Now the question is, how do we make it as resilient as carving in stone? How do we do that? How do we make something resilient as stone, but as permeable as gas? That's the magic in blockchain. So that's where I think we'll end up.
It's exciting times for sure here in Singapore. And it's been a pleasure speaking to all three of you. Thank you so much for being on the show. And we'll talk next time. Thank you.
Thank you.